Bob, for not being Rodney. Everything is fine, love, just on my way into work. What's up? Rob launched into a long story as Rachel kept walking towards the school office. She went by one of the year one classrooms and heard bubbles of children's laughter floating out the door. As she glanced in, she saw her boss, Trudy Appleby, streak across the classroom with one arm lifted in the air, like a superhero, while the year one teacher put her hand over her eyes and giggled helplessly. Was that a disco strobe light flashing white lights around the room? Tess O'Leary's little boy certainly wouldn't be bored on his first day of school, that was for sure. As for that report Trudy was meant to be working on for the Department of Education, Rachel sighed. She'd give her until 10 a.m., and then she'd drag her back to her desk. "So is that okay, then?" said Rob. "You'll come to Lauren's parents on Sunday?" "What's that?" said Rachel. She walked into her office and put her handbag on her desk. "I thought maybe you could bring a pavlova, if you like." "Bring a pavlova where? When?" She couldn't process what Rob was going on about. She heard Rob take a deep breath. "On Easter Sunday, for lunch, with Lauren's family. I know we said we'd come to you for lunch, but it's just impossible to fit everything in. We've been so busy with all the arrangements for New York. So then we thought if you came over to their place, we could see both families at once." Lauren's family. Lauren's mother had always been to the ballet or the opera or the theatre the night before, and whatever it was would have been simply extraordinary or exquisite. Lauren's father was a retired barrister who would exchange a few courteous pleasantries with Rachel before abruptly turning away with a politely baffled expression on his face, as if he couldn't quite place who she was. There was always a stranger at the table, someone beautiful and exotic-looking who would dominate the conversation with endless talk of their recent fascinating trip to India or Iran, and everybody except Rachel and Jacob would find them enthralling. There appeared to be an endless supply of these colourful guests, because Rachel had never met the same one twice. It was like they were hired as guest speakers for the occasion. "Fine," said Rachel resignedly. She would take Jacob off and play with him in the garden. Anything was bearable if she had Jacob. "That's fine. I'll bring the pavlova." Rob loved her pavlovas. Bless him. He never seemed to notice that Rachel's wonky-looking pavlovas were a somewhat lowbrow addition to the table. "By the way, Lauren wanted to know if you wanted her to pick up any more of those biscuit things, whatever they were, that we brought over the other night." "That's nice of her, but actually they were a little sweet for me," said Rachel. "She also said to ask if you had fun at the Tupperware party last night." Lauren must have noticed Marla's invitation on the fridge when she picked up Jacob on Monday. Show off. "Look how interested I am in my mother-in-law's elderly little life." "It was perfectly fine," said Rachel. Would she tell him about the video? Would it upset him? Please him? He had a right to know. She sometimes felt uneasily aware of how little notice she'd taken of Rob's grief, how she'd just wanted him to stay out of her way, to go to bed, to watch TV, to let her cry in private. "Bit boring, eh, Mum?" "It was fine. Actually, when I got home..." "Hey, I got Jacob's passport photo done before work yesterday. Wait till you see it. So cute." Janie had never had a passport. Yet Jacob, at just 2 years old, had a passport that allowed him to leave the country at barely a moment's notice. "I can't wait to see it," said Rachel. She would not tell Rob about the video. He was far too busy with his own important, jet-setting life to worry about an investigation into his sister's murder. There was a pause. Rob wasn't stupid. "We haven't forgotten about Friday," he said. "I know this time of year is always hard for you. Actually, speaking of Friday..." He seemed to be waiting for her to say something. Was this, in fact, the whole point of the phone call? "Yes," she said impatiently. "What about Friday?" "Lauren tried to talk to you about it the other night. It's her idea." "Well, it's not. It's not at all. It's my idea. It's just something she said that made me think it might..." "So, anyway, I know you always go to the park." "To that park. I know you normally go on your own. But I wondered if maybe I could come too. With Lauren and Jacob, if that's all right." "I know you don't need us there," interrupted Rob. He sounded unusually terse. "But I'd like to be there this time. For Jamie. To show her that..." Rachel heard his voice crack. He cleared his throat and spoke again with a deeper voice. "And then afterwards there's that nice cafe near the station. Lauren said it's open on Good Friday. We could have breakfast afterwards." He coughed and said hastily, "Or just coffee, at least." Rachel imagined Lauren standing in the park, looking solemn and stylish. She'd wear a cream trench coat, pulled in tight at the waist, and her hair would be in a shiny, low ponytail that didn't swing too jauntily. And her lipstick would be a neutral colour, not too bright, and she'd say and do all the right things at all the right times, and somehow turn "Marking the anniversary of your husband's sister's murder" into another perfectly managed event on her social calendar. "I think I'd really prefer..." she began, but then she thought of the way Rob's voice had cracked. It was all orchestrated by Lauren, of course. But maybe it was something that Rob needed. Maybe he needed it more than Rachel needed to be alone. "All right," she said. "That's fine with me. I normally get there very early, around 6 a.m. But Jacob is up at the crack of dawn these days, isn't he?" "Yes, he is. So we'll be there. Thank you. It means I've actually got a really full plate today, so if you don't mind..." They'd taken up the phone for long enough. Rodney had probably been trying to call and couldn't get through. "Bye, Mum," said Rob sadly. Chapter 23. Cecilia's home was beautiful, welcoming, and filled with light from big windows that looked out on a perfectly tended backyard and swimming pool. The walls were hung with sweet, funny family photos and framed children's drawings. Everything was shining and tidy, but not in an overly formal, forbidding way. The sofas looked comfy and squishy. There were bookshelves crammed with books and interesting-looking knick-knacks. There was evidence of Cecilia's daughters everywhere. Sports equipment, a cello, a pair of ballet slippers. But everything was in its absolutely correct place. It was like the house was up for sale, and it was being marketed by the real estate agent as the ideal family home. "I love your house," said Tess, as Cecilia led her through to the kitchen. "Thank you. It's..." "Oh!" Cecilia stopped abruptly at the kitchen door. "I do apologize for this mess." Walking in behind her, Tess said, "You're kidding, right?" There was a handful of breakfast bowls on an island bench, a half-drunk glass of apple juice sitting on top of the microwave, a solitary carton of Sultana bran, and a small pile of books on the kitchen table. Everything else was in perfect shining order. Tess watched in bemusement as Cecilia whirled around the kitchen. Within seconds, she'd stowed the dishes in the dishwasher, put the cereal away in a giant pantry, and was polishing the kitchen sink with a paper towel. "We ran unusually late this morning," explained Cecilia as she scrubbed at the sink as if her life depended on it. "Normally, I can't leave the house unless everything is perfect. I know I'm ridiculous. My sister says I have that disorder. What is it? Obsessive compulsive, that's it? OCD. Tess thought her sister might have a point. "You should rest," she said. "Have a seat. Would you like a cup of tea?" "Coffee," said Cecilia frantically. "I have muffins, biscuits." She stopped, pressed her hand to her forehead, and briefly closed her eyes. "Goodness, that is, what was I saying?" "I think I should make you a cup of tea." "I might actually need to." Cecilia pulled out a chair and then stopped, transfixed by the sight of her shoes. "My shoes don't match," she said, awestruck.
"No one would have noticed," said Tess.
Cecilia sat down and rested her elbows on the table. She gave Tess a rueful, almost shy smile. "I have a reputation at St. Angela's for being the opposite of this."
"Oh, well," said Tess.
She filled a very shiny kettle with water and noticed that she'd left a few droplets on Cecilia's perfect sink. "Your secret is safe with me." Worried that she'd implied that Cecilia's behaviour was somehow shameful, she quickly changed the subject. "Is one of your daughters doing an assignment on the Berlin Wall?" She nodded at the pile of books on the table.
"My daughter Esther is learning about it for her own interest," said Cecilia. "She gets crazily interested in these different topics. We all end up becoming experts. It can be a bit draining." "Anyway," she took a deep breath and suddenly turned in her chair to face Tess as if they were at a dinner party and Cecilia had decided it was time to focus on her instead of the guest on her other side.
"Have you been to Berlin, Tess?" The pitch of her voice was not quite right. Was she about to be sick again? Could Cecilia be on drugs? Mentally ill?
"No, actually."
Tess opened Cecilia's pantry door to find tea bags, and her eyes widened at the array of labelled Tupperware containers of all shapes and sizes. It was like a magazine ad. "I've been to Europe a few times, but my cousin, Felicity..." She stopped. She'd been about to say that her cousin Felicity wasn't interested in Germany, and so therefore she'd never been. And she was struck for the first time by what an odd thing that was to say. As if her own feelings about seeing Germany were of no consequence. What were her own feelings about Germany? She saw a tray set out with rows of tea bags.
"Gosh, you've got everything. Which tea would you like?"
"Oh, Earl Grey. Just black, no sugar. Really, please, let me." Cecilia went to stand up.
Sit,
said Tess, almost bossily, as if she'd known Cecilia forever. If Cecilia was behaving unlike herself, so was Tess. Cecilia sat back down. A thought occurred to Tess. "Will Polly need her sports shoes straight away? Should I rush back to the school with them?" Cecilia started.
"I forgot about Polly's sport again. I completely forgot."
Tess smiled at how appalled Cecilia looked.
It was like she was forgetting things for the first time in her whole life. Cecilia said slowly, "They don't go up to the Oval until 10. "In that case, I'll have a cup of tea with you," said Tess. She helped herself to an unopened packet of expensive-looking chocolate biscuits from Cecilia's extraordinary pantry, somewhat thrilled by her temerity. Oh, this was living life on the edge, all right. And a biscuit? Chapter 24. Cecilia watched Tess lift her cup of tea to her mouth. She'd used the wrong mugs. Cecilia never used those mugs for guests. And smile at her over the rim, unaware of the terrible monologue running silently through Cecilia's head. "Want to know what I found out last night, Tess? My husband murdered Janie Crowley."
"I know. Wow, hey?
"Yep. Rachel Crowley's daughter. That's right. The nice white-haired lady with the sad eyes. The one who walked past us this morning and looked me right in the eyes and smiled. So I'm in a bit of a pickle, to be honest, Tess, as my mother would say. A real pickle." What would Tess say if Cecilia actually spoke those words out loud? Cecilia had thought Tess was one of those mysterious, self-assured types who didn't need to fill silent gaps with conversation. But it occurred to her now that perhaps she was shy. There was something brave about the way she met Cecilia's eyes and sat with careful, straight-backed posture, as if she was a child behaving well at someone else's house. She was really being very nice to Cecilia, driving her home after that humiliating incident in the gutter. Was Cecilia going to throw up every time she saw Rachel Crowley from now on? Because that could be complicated. Tess tilted her head at the Berlin Wall books. "I always like reading about the escape attempts."
"Me too," said Cecilia.
"The successful ones, that is." She opened one of the books to the section of photos in the middle. "See this family?" She pointed at a black-and-white photo of a young man and woman and their four small, scruffy children. "This man hijacked a train. Cannonball Harry, they called him. He drove the train at full speed through the barriers. The conductor was saying, 'Are you crazy, comrade?' They all had to get down under the seats so they wouldn't get shot. Can you imagine? Not being him, being her, the mother. I keep thinking about it. Four children lying on the floor of a train, bullets flying over their heads." She made up a fairy story to keep them distracted. She said she'd never made up a story for them before. Actually, I never make up stories for my children either. I'm not creative. I bet you make up stories for your children, don't you? Tess chewed at her thumbnail. "Sometimes, I guess." "I'm talking too much," thought Cecilia, and then she realized she'd said, "your children," when Tess only had the one child, and she wondered if she should correct herself. But what if Tess desperately wanted more children, but couldn't have them for some reason? Tess turned the book around to face her and looked at the photo. "I guess it shows what you'll do for freedom. We just take it for granted." "But I think if I'd been his wife, I would have said no," said Cecilia. She sounded too agitated, as if she really was faced with this choice. She made a conscious effort to calm her voice. "I don't think I would have been brave enough. I would have said, 'It's not worth it. Who cares if we're stuck behind this wall? At least we're alive. At least our children are alive. Death is too high a price for freedom.'" What was the price for John Paul's freedom? Rachel Crowley? Was she the price? Her peace of mind? The peace of mind she would have in at last knowing what had happened to her daughter, and why, and that the person responsible was being punished? Cecilia still felt rage at a preschool teacher who had once made Isabel cry. Isabel didn't even remember it, for heaven's sake. So how must Rachel feel? Cecilia's stomach churned. She put her tea back down. "You've gone completely white," said Tess. "I guess I've got a virus," said Cecilia. "My husband has given me a virus. A really nasty virus." To her horror, she actually laughed out loud. "Or something. I've got something, that's for sure." Chapter 25. As Tess drove Cecilia's car up to the school to drop off Polly's sports shoes, it occurred to her that if Polly was doing sport today, then Liam would be doing sport too, because weren't they in the same class? And of course, he wasn't wearing sports shoes. Nobody had told Tess it was PE day. Or perhaps they had, but she hadn't registered it. She wondered if she should stop at her mother's house and pick up Liam's runners. She wavered. Nobody ever told you that being a mother was all about making what seemed like thousands of tiny decisions. Tess had always considered herself quite a decisive person before she'd had Liam. Well, it was past 10 o'clock. She'd better not risk getting Polly's shoes there late. It seemed to matter so much, and Tess didn't want to let Cecilia down. The poor woman really did seem very sick. Cecilia had said to take the shoes either to Polly's classroom or straight to the PE teacher. "You'll probably see Connor Whitby on the oval," she'd said. "That might be easiest." "I know Connor," Tess had surprised herself by saying. "I actually went out with him for a while. Years ago. Ancient history now, of course." She cringed, remembering the ancient history part. Why had she said that? So pointless and nerdy. Cecilia had seemed quite impressed. "Well, he's currently St. Angela's most eligible bachelor. I won't tell Polly that you once dated him, or else she'll have to kill you." But then she'd given another one of those disconcerting, high-pitched giggles and said she was very sorry, but she had to go and lie down that very second. When Tess found him, Connor was in the process of carefully placing basketballs in the center of each colored segment of a giant, multicolored parachute laid out on the oval. He was wearing a very white T-shirt and black tracksuit pants, and looked less intimidating than last night at the petrol station. The sunlight showed up the deep lines around his eyes. "Hello again?" He smiled as she handed over the shoes. "For Liam, I assume." "You kissed me for the first time on a beach," thought Tess. "No, these are for Polly Fitzpatrick. Cecilia is sick, and I offered to bring them up for her. Liam doesn't have any of his sports gear, actually. You won't put him on detention, will you?" There it was again, that mildly flirtatious sound in her voice. Why was she flirting with him? Because she'd just remembered their first kiss? Because Felicity had never liked him? Because her marriage had fallen apart and she needed urgent proof that she was still attractive? Because she was angry? Because she was sad? Because why the hell not? "I'll go gentle on him." Connor carefully placed Polly's little shoes off to the side of the parachute. "Does Liam like sport?"
"He likes running," said Tess. "Running for no reason at all." She thought of Will. He was an obsessive AFL fan, and when Liam was a baby, he talked so excitedly about how he'd take him along to matches. But so far, Liam had zero interest in Will's passion. Tess knew he must be bitterly disappointed, but he'd laughed it off, made the joke on him. Once they'd been watching a match together on TV, and Tess had heard Liam say, "Let's go outside and run, Dad." Will, who didn't really enjoy running at all, had sighed with comic resignation, and the next thing the TV was off, and they were running in circles around the backyard. She would not let Felicity ruin that relationship. She would not have Liam one day making awkward conversation with a father who didn't really know him. "Is he okay about starting at a new school?" asked Connor. "I thought he was," said Tess. She fiddled with Cecilia's car keys. "But he was upset this morning. He misses his dad. His dad and I are... Anyway, I stupidly thought Liam was oblivious to some things that were going on." "They surprise you with how smart they are," said Connor. He took another two basketballs from the cloth bag and held them against his chest. "Then, next thing, they surprise you with how stupid they are. But if it makes you feel better, this is a lovely school. I've never taught at such a caring school. It comes from the school principal. She's a nutcase, but the children come first." "It must be a very different world from accounting." Tess watched the bright primary colours of the parachute gently rippling in the breeze.
"Ha! You knew me when I was an accountant," said Connor.
He gave her a friendly, tender smile, as if he was much fonder of her than he could possibly be after all this time.
"I forgot that for some reason."
"Clontarf Beach," thought Tess suddenly. "That's where you kissed me for the first time. It was a good first kiss."
"It was all such a long time ago," she said. Her heart rate had picked up. "I can hardly remember so much."
"I can hardly remember so much." It didn't even make sense.
"Really?" said Connor. He squatted down and placed one of the balls on the red segment of the parachute. As he straightened, he shot her a look. "I actually remember quite a lot."
What did he mean? That he remembered a lot about their relationship? Or just that he remembered a lot about the 90s.
"I'd better go," she said. She met his eyes and looked away fast, as if she'd done something wildly inappropriate. "Get out of your way."
"All right."
Connor bounced the basketball back and forth between his palms. "Still up for that coffee sometime?"
"Sure," said Tess. She smiled in his general direction.
"Have fun
parachuting, or whatever it is you're doing."
"Will do. And I promise I'll keep an eye on Liam."
She started to walk off, and as she did, she remembered how much Felicity liked watching the football with Will. It was something they had in common, a shared interest. Tess would sit and read her book while they shouted together at the TV. She turned around. "Let's make it a drink," she said. And this time she did meet his eyes. It felt like physical contact. "I mean, instead of a coffee." Connor shifted one of the balls on the parachute with the side of his foot.
"How about tonight?"
Chapter 26. Cecilia sat weeping on the floor of her pantry, her arms wrapped around her knees. She reached up for the roll of paper towels on the bottom shelf, ripped one off, and blew her nose furiously. She couldn't remember why she'd come into the pantry in the first place. Maybe she'd come in for no other reason than to calm her mind by looking at her Tupperware containers. the pleasing, purposeful geometry of their interlocking shapes, their blue, airtight lids keeping everything fresh and crisp. There were no rotting secrets in Cecilia's pantry. She could smell a hint of sesame oil. She was always so careful to wipe the bottle of sesame oil, but still that faint scent lingered. Maybe she should throw it out. But John Paul loved her sesame chicken. Who cared what John Paul loved? The marital scales would never be even again. She had the upper hand and the last word forever. The doorbell rang, and Cecilia gasped. The police, she thought. But there was no reason for the police to turn up now, after all these years, just because Cecilia knew. I hate you for this, John Paul Fitzpatrick, she thought, as she got to her feet. Her neck ached. She took the bottle of sesame oil and tossed it into the bin on her way to the front door. It wasn't the police. It was John Paul's mother. Cecilia blinked, disoriented. "Were you in the bathroom?" said Virginia. "I was just thinking I might have to sit down on the step. My legs were getting all wobbly." Virginia's specialty was making you feel just a little bad about anything she could. She had 5 sons and 5 daughters-in-law, and Cecilia was the only daughter-in-law who hadn't at one time been reduced to tears of rage and frustration by Virginia. It was due to Cecilia's unshakable confidence in her abilities as a wife, mother, and housewife. "Bring it on, Virginia," she sometimes thought to herself as Virginia's gaze swept over everything from John Paul's crease-free shirts to Cecilia's dust-free skirting boards. Virginia dropped by Cecilia's every Wednesday after her Tai Chi class for a cup of tea and something freshly baked. "How do you stand it?" Cecilia's sisters-in-law moaned, but Cecilia didn't really mind all that much. It was like taking part in a weekly battle with an unspecified goal that Cecilia felt she generally won. But not today. She didn't have the strength for it today. "What's that smell?" said Virginia as she presented her cheek to be kissed. "Is it sesame oil?" "Yes." Cecilia sniffed her hands. "Come and sit down. I'll put the kettle on." "I'm really not fond of the smell of sesame," said Virginia. "It's very Asian, isn't it?" She settled herself down at the table and looked about the kitchen for grime or errors of judgment. "How was John Paul last night? He called this morning. That was nice that he rushed back earlier than expected. The girls must be happy. They're all such daddy's girls, your 3, aren't they? But I couldn't believe it when I heard he had to go straight back into the office this morning after only flying back last night. He must have jet lag, the poor man." John Paul had wanted to stay home today. "I don't want to leave you alone to deal with this," he'd said. "I won't go into the office at all. We can talk. We can keep talking." Cecilia could think of nothing worse than more talking. She'd insisted that he go into work, virtually pushing him out the door. She needed to be away from him. She needed to think. He'd been calling all morning, leaving frantic-sounding messages. Was he worried she was going to tell the police what she knew? "John Paul has a good work ethic," she told her mother-in-law as she made tea. "Imagine if you knew what your precious son did. Just imagine." She felt Virginia's eyes shrewdly assessing her. She was no fool, Virginia. That was the mistake Cecilia's sisters-in-law made. They underestimated the enemy. "You don't look very well," said Virginia. "You're washed out. Probably exhausted, are you? You take on far too much. I hear you did a party last night. I was chatting to Marla Evans at Tai Chi, and she said it was a great success. Everyone got tipsy, apparently. She mentioned that you drove Rachel Crowley home.
Rachel is very nice, said Cecilia.
She put Virginia's tea in front of her, along with a selection of baked treats. Virginia's weakness. It helped give Cecilia the edge. Could she talk about her without feeling nauseous?
I actually asked her to Polly's pirate party next weekend.
Which is just wonderful.
Did you? Said Virginia.
There was a pause.
Does John Paul know that?
Yes, said Cecilia. He does, actually. It was an odd question for Virginia to ask. She knew perfectly well that John Paul didn't get involved in the planning of birthday parties. She put the milk back in the fridge and turned around to look at Virginia.
Why do you ask?
Virginia helped herself to the coconut lemon slice.
He didn't mind?
Why should he mind? Cecilia carefully pulled out a chair and sat down at the table. She felt like someone was pushing their thumb right through the center of her forehead, as if her head was made of dough. Her eyes met Virginia's. She had John Paul's eyes. She'd been a beauty once and had never forgiven one of her hapless daughters-in-law for not recognizing her in a photo hanging in the family room. Virginia looked away first.
I just thought he might prefer not to have too many ring-ins at his daughter's party.
Her voice was off-key. She took a bite of the slice and chewed it awkwardly, as if she was only pretending to chew. She knows. The thought dropped straight into Cecilia's head with a thud. John Paul said nobody knew. He was adamant that nobody knew. They were silent for a few moments. Cecilia heard the refrigerator hum. She felt her heart race. Virginia couldn't know, could she? She swallowed, a sudden involuntary gulp for air.
I talked to Rachel about her daughter, said Cecilia.
She sounded breathless.
About Janie, on the way home.
She paused, took a breath to calm herself. Virginia had put down the slice and was scrabbling for something in her handbag.
Do you remember much about when it happened?
I remember it very well, said Virginia. She pulled a tissue from her bag and blew her nose. The papers loved it. They had pages and pages of photos. They even showed a photo of the... She crumpled the tissue in her hand and cleared her throat. The rosary beads. The crucifix was made of mother of pearl. The rosary beads. John Paul had said that his mother had lent him her rosary beads because he had an exam that day. She must have recognized them and never said a word, never asked the questions so she'd never need to hear the answer. But she knew. She absolutely knew. Cecilia felt a clammy, shivery sensation creeping up her legs, like the start of the flu.
But that was all such a very long time ago, said Virginia.
Yes, although it must be so distressing for Rachel, said Cecilia. Not knowing what happened. Their eyes locked across the table. This time Virginia didn't look away. Cecilia could see tiny particles of orange face powder embedded in the drawstring of wrinkles around Virginia's mouth. Outside the house, she could hear the soft midweek sounds of her neighborhood. the chatter of cockatoos, the twitter of sparrows, the far-off buzz of someone's leaf blower, the slam of a car door. Although it wouldn't really change anything, would it? It wouldn't bring Janie back. Virginia patted Cecilia's arm. You've got enough on your mind without worrying about that. Your family comes first. Your husband and your daughters. They come first.
Yes, of course, began Cecilia, and stopped abruptly.
The message was loud and clear. The taint of sin was all through her house. It smelled like sesame oil. Virginia smiled sweetly and picked up the coconut lemon slice again between her fingertips.
I don't need to tell you this, do I? You're a mother. You'd do anything for your children. Just like I'd do anything for mine.
Chapter 27. The school day was nearly over, and Rachel was busy typing up the school newsletter, her fingers moving rapidly over the keyboard. Sushi is now available at the tuck shop. Healthy and yummy. More volunteers are needed to cover library books. Don't forget the excellent Easter bonnet parade tomorrow. Connor Whitby has been charged with the murder of Rachel Crowley's daughter. Hooray! Our warmest wishes to Rachel. Applications now open for the position of PE teacher. Her little finger hit the delete key. Delete. Delete. Her mobile phone buzzed and vibrated on the desk next to her computer, and she snatched it up.
Mrs. Crowley! It's Rodney Bellark.
Rodney, said Rachel, do you have good news for me?
Well, not... Well, I just wanted to let you know that I've given the tape to a good mate at the Unsolved Homicide Team, said Rodney.
He sounded stilted, as if he'd carefully scripted his words before he picked up the phone.
So... It's absolutely in the right hands.
That's good, said Rachel. That's a start. They'll reopen the case.
Well, Mrs. Crowley, the thing is, Janie's case isn't closed, said Rodney. It's still open. When the coroner returns an open finding, as they did with Janie, as you know, well, it stays open. So what I'm saying is the boys will take a look at the tape. They'll certainly look at it.
And they'll interview Connor again, said Rachel. She pressed the phone hard against her ear.
I guess that's a possibility, said Rodney. But please don't get your hopes up too high, Mrs. Crowley. Please don't.
The disappointment felt personal, as if she was being told she'd failed some test. She wasn't good enough. She'd failed to help her daughter. She'd failed her again.
But, look, that's just my opinion. The new guys are younger and smarter than me. Someone from the Unsolved Homicide Team will call you this week and let you know what they think.
As she put down the phone and returned to the computer, Rachel felt her eyes blur. She realized she'd had a warm sense of anticipation all day, as if finding the tape was going to set in motion a series of events that would lead to something wonderful. Almost as if she'd thought the tape was going to bring Janie back. An infantile part of her mind had never accepted that her daughter could be murdered. Surely one day some respectable authority figure would take charge and put it right. Maybe God was the reasonable, respectable figure she'd always assumed was going to step in. Could she really have been that deluded? Even subconsciously? God didn't care. God didn't care less. God gave Connor Whitby free will, and Connor used that free will to strangle Janie. Rachel pushed her chair back from her desk and looked out the window at the schoolyard. She had a bird's eye view from up here and could see everything that was going on. It was nearly school pickup time. Parents were scattered about the place, little groups of mums deep in conversation, the occasional father lurking in the background, checking his email on his mobile phone. She watched one of the fathers quickly step aside for someone in a wheelchair. It was Lucy O'Leary. Her daughter Tess was pushing the chair. As Rachel watched, Tess bent down to hear something that her mother said, and threw back her head and laughed. There was something quietly subversive about those two. You could become friends with your grown-up daughter in a way that didn't seem possible with your grown-up son. That was what Connor took away from Rachel. All the future relationships she could have had with Janie. I am not the first mother to lose a child, Rachel kept telling herself that first year. I am not the first. I will not be the last. It made no difference, of course. The buzzer went for the end of the school day, and seconds later the children tumbled out of their classrooms. There was that familiar afternoon babble of childish voices, laughing, shouting, crying. Rachel saw the little O'Leary boy run to his grandmother's wheelchair. He nearly tripped because he was using both hands to awkwardly carry a giant cardboard construction covered in aluminium foil. Tess bent down next to her mother's wheelchair, and all three of them examined whatever it was. A spaceship, perhaps. No doubt it was Trudy Appleby's doing. Forget the syllabus. If Trudy decided Year One was making spaceships that day, so it would be. Lauren and Rob were going to end up staying in New York. Jacob would have an American accent. He'd eat pancakes for breakfast. Rachel would never see him run out of his school carrying something covered in aluminium foil. The police wouldn't do anything with the videotape. They'd put it on file. They probably didn't even have a VCR to watch it on. Rachel turned back to her computer screen and let her hands splay limply on the keys. She'd been waiting 28 years for something that was never going to happen. Chapter 28. It had been a mistake suggesting a drink. What had she been thinking? The bar was crowded with young, beautiful, drunk people. Tess kept staring at them. They all looked like high school students to her, who should have been at home studying, not out on a school night, shrieking and squawking. Connor had found them a table, which was lucky, but it was right next to a row of flashing, beeping poker machines. And it was clear from the panicked concentration on Connor's face each time she spoke that he was having difficulty hearing her. Tess sipped a glass of not especially good wine and felt her head begin to ache. Her legs were sore after that long walk up the hill from Cecilia's place. She did that one body combat class with Felicity on Tuesday nights, but she couldn't seem to manage to fit in any other time for exercise in between work and school and all of Liam's activities. She remembered suddenly that she'd just paid $190 for a martial arts course that Liam was meant to have started in Melbourne today. Shit, shit, shit. What was she doing here anyway? She'd forgotten how bad Sydney bars were compared to Melbourne. That's why there wasn't anyone over 30 in this place. If you were a grown-up living on the North Shore, you had to do your drinking at home and be tucked up in bed by 10 o'clock. She missed Melbourne. She missed Will. She missed Felicity. She missed her life. Connor leaned forward.
Liam has pretty good hand-eye coordination, he shouted. For God's sake, was this a parent-teacher conference now?
When Tess had picked Liam up from school this afternoon, he'd seemed elated and hadn't mentioned anything about Will or Felicity. Instead, he'd talked non-stop about how he was definitely the best at the Easter egg hunt and how he'd shared some of his eggs with Polly Fitzpatrick, who was going to have this amazing pirate party, and everyone in the class was invited, and how he'd done this really fun game with a parachute on the Oval, and there was an Easter hat parade on the next day, and their teacher was going to dress up like an Easter egg. Tess didn't know if it was just the novelty factor or the chocolate high that was making him so happy. But for now, at least, Liam was definitely not missing his old life.
"Did you miss Marcus?" she'd asked him.
"Not really," Liam had answered. "Marcus was pretty mean." He'd refused help making his Easter hat and had made his own weird and wonderful creation out of an old straw hat of Lucy's, incorporating fake flowers and a toy rabbit. Then he'd eaten all his dinner, sung in the bath, and been sound asleep by 7:30 p.m. Whatever happened, he wasn't going back to that school in Melbourne.
"He gets it from his father," sighed Tess, "the good hand-eye coordination."
She took a big mouthful of the bad wine. Will would never take her anywhere like this. He knew all the best bars in Melbourne. Tiny, stylish, soft-lit bars where he'd sit across the table from her and they'd talk. The conversation never faltered. They still made each other laugh. They went out every couple of months, just the two of them, saw a show or had dinner. Wasn't that what you were meant to do? To invest in your marriage with nice, regular date nights? She couldn't stand that phrase. Felicity took care of Liam when they went out. They always had a drink with her when they got home and told her about their night. Sometimes, if it was too late, she stayed the night and they all had breakfast together in the morning. Yes, Felicity had been an integral part of date night. Did she lie in the spare bedroom wishing she was in Tess's place? Had Tess's behaviour been unwittingly yet unspeakably cruel to Felicity?
"What's that?"
Connor leaned forward, squinting at her.
"He gets it! Booyah!"
There was an explosion of noise around one of the poker machines.
"You bitch! You total bitch!"
One of the pretty young girls, skanky, Felicity would have described her, slapped her friend's back while a torrent of coins cascaded from the machine.
"Booyah, booyah, booyah!"
A broad-chested young man, pummeling his chest like a gorilla, lurched sideways against Tess.
"Watch it, mate," said Connor. "Man, I'm so sorry. We just won..."
The boy turned around and his face lit up.
"Mr. Whippy! Hey, guys, this is my primary school PE teacher. He was, like, the best PE teacher ever."
He stuck out his hand, and Connor stood and shook it, shooting a rueful look at Tess.
"How the hell are you, Mr. Whitby?"
The boy shoved his hands in his jeans pockets and shook his head as he looked at Connor, seemingly overcome with a sort of paternal emotion.
"I'm good, Daniel," said Connor. "How are you?"
The boy was suddenly struck by an astonishing thought.
"You know what? I'm gonna buy you a drink, Mr. Whitby. It would be my fucking pleasure. Seriously. Excuse my language. I may be intoxicated. What are you drinking, Mr. Whitby?"
You know what, Daniel, that would have been great.
but we were actually just leaving.
Connor held out his hand to Tess, and she automatically picked up her bag, got to her feet, and took it, as naturally as if they'd been in a relationship for years.
"Is this Mrs. Whitby?"
The boy looked Tess up and down, entranced. He turned to Connor and gave him a big, sly wink and a thumbs-up gesture. He turned to Tess.
"Mrs. Whitby, your husband is a legend, an absolute legend. He taught me, like, long jump and hockey and cricket and like, every sport in the fucking universe. And, you know, I look athletic. I know, and I am, but it might surprise you to learn that I'm not that coordinated. But Mr. Whitby, he..."
"Gotta go, mate."
Connor clapped the boy on the shoulder.
"It was good seeing you." "Ah, likewise, man. Likewise."
Connor led Tess out of the bar and into the wonderfully quiet night air.
"Sorry," he said. "I was just losing my mind in there. I think I'm going deaf." And then a drunk ex-student offering to buy me drinks? Jeez.
"So, it looks like I'm still holding your hand."
"It looks like you are."
"What are you doing, Tess O'Leary?" But she didn't let go. If Will could fall in love with Felicity, if Felicity could fall in love with Will, she could spend a few moments holding hands with an ex-boyfriend. Why not?
"I remember that I always loved your hands," said Connor.
He cleared his throat.
"I guess that's bordering on inappropriate."
"Oh, well," said Tess. He moved his thumb so gently across her knuckle, it was almost imperceptible. She had forgotten this, the way your senses exploded and your pulse raced, as if you were properly awake after a long sleep. She had forgotten the thrill, the desire, the melting sensation. It just wasn't possible after 10 years of marriage. Everyone knew that. It was part of the deal. She'd accepted the deal. It had never been a problem. She hadn't even known she'd missed it. If she ever thought about it, it felt childish, silly. Sparks flying. Whatever, who cares? She had a child to care for, a business to run. But my God, she'd forgotten the power of it. How nothing else felt important. This was what Will had been experiencing with Felicity, while Tess was busy with mundane married life. Connor increased the pressure of his thumb just fractionally, and Tess felt a shot of desire. Maybe the only reason Tess had never cheated on Will was because she'd never had the opportunity. Actually, she'd never cheated on any of her boyfriends. Her sexual history was unimpeachable. She'd never had a one-night stand with an inappropriate boy, never drunkenly kissed someone else's boyfriend, never woken up with a single regret. She'd always done the right thing. Why? For what? Who cared? Tess kept her eyes on Connor's thumb and watched, hypnotized and astonished, as it ever so gently grazed her knuckle. June 1987, Berlin. The US President, Ronald Reagan, spoke in West Berlin and said,
"General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
in June 1987, Sydney. Andrew and Lucy O'Leary spoke quietly across their kitchen table while their 10-year-old daughter slept upstairs. "It's not that I can't forgive you," said Andrew. "It's that I don't care. I don't even care."
"I only did it to make you look at me," said Lucy.
But Andrew's eyes were already looking past her, at the door.
Chapter 29. "How come we're not having lamb?" asked Polly. "We always have a lamb roast when Daddy comes home."
She poked her fork discontentedly at the piece of overcooked fish on her plate.
"Why did you cook fish for dinner?" said Isabel to Cecilia. "Dad hates fish."
"I don't hate fish," said John Paul.
"You do so," said Esther.
"Well, okay, it's not my favorite," said John Paul, "but this is actually very nice."
"It's not actually very nice."
Polly put down her fork and sighed.
"Polly Fitzpatrick, where are your manners?" said John Paul. "Your mother went to all the trouble of cooking this."
"Don't."
Cecilia held up her hand. There was silence around the table for a moment as everyone waited for her to say something else. She put down her fork and had a large mouthful of her wine.
"I thought you gave up wine for Lent," said Isabel.
"Changed my mind," said Cecilia.
"You can't just change your mind."
Polly was scandalized.
"Did everybody have a good day today?" asked John Paul.
"This house smells of sesame oil," said Esther, sniffing.
"Yeah, I thought we were having sesame chicken," said Isabel.
"Fish is brain food," said John Paul. "It makes us smart."
"So why aren't Eskimos like the smartest people in the world?" said Esther.
"Maybe they are," said John Paul.
"This fish tastes really bad," said Polly.
"Has an Eskimo ever won the Nobel Prize?" asked Esther.
"It does taste a bit funny, Mum," said Isabel.
Cecilia stood up and began clearing their full plates away. Her daughters looked stunned.
"You can all have toast."
"It's fine,"
protested John Paul, holding onto the edge of his plate with his fingertips.
I was quite enjoying it."
Cecilia pulled his plate away.
"No, you weren't."
She avoided his eyes. She hadn't made eye contact with him since he got home. If she behaved normally, if she let life just continue on, wasn't she condoning it? Accepting it? Betraying Rachel Crowley's daughter? Except, wasn't that exactly what she'd already decided to do? To do nothing? So what difference did it make if she was cold towards John Paul? Did she really think that made a difference?
"Don't worry, Rachel. I'm being so mean to your daughter's murderer. No lamb roast for him. No siree."
Her glass was empty again. Gosh, that went down fast. She took the bottle of wine from the fridge and refilled it to the very brim. Tess and Connor lay on their backs, breathing raggedly.
"Well," said Connor finally.
"Well, indeed," said Tess.
"We seem to be in the hallway," said Connor.
"We do seem to be."
"I was trying to get us to the living room, at least," said Connor.
"It seems like a very nice hallway," said Tess. "Not that I can see all that much." They were in Connor's dark apartment, lying on the hallway floor. She could feel a thin rug beneath her back. And possibly floorboards. The apartment smelled pleasantly of garlic and laundry powder. She'd followed him home in her mother's car. He'd kissed her at the security door to the building. Then he'd kissed her again in the stairwell. And for quite a long time at the front door. And then once he'd got the key in the door, they were suddenly doing that crazy tear each other's clothes off banging into walls thing that you never do once you're in a long-term relationship, because it seems too theatrical and not really worth the bother anyway, especially if there's something good on TV. "I'd better get a condom," Connor had said in her ear at a crucial point in the proceedings, and Tess had said, "I'm on the pill. You seem disease-free, so just please, oh, God, please, just go right ahead." "Rightio," he'd said, and done just that. Now Tess readjusted her clothes and waited to feel ashamed. She was a married woman. She was not in love with this man. The only reason she was here was because her husband had fallen in love with someone else. Just a few days earlier, this scenario would have been laughable, inconceivable. She should be filled with self-loathing. She should feel seedy and slutty and sinful. But actually, what she felt right now was cheerful. Really cheerful. Almost absurdly cheerful, in fact. She thought of Will and Felicity and their sad, earnest faces just before she threw cold coffee at them. She recalled that Felicity had been wearing a new white silk blouse. That coffee stain would never come out. Her eyes adjusted, but Connor was still just a shadowy silhouette lying next to her. She could feel the warmth of his body all along her right side. He was bigger, stronger, and in much better shape than Will. She thought of Will's short, stocky, hairy body. So familiar and dear. The body of a family member, although always sexy to her. She had thought Will was the last bullet point in her sexual history. She had thought she wouldn't sleep with anyone else for the rest of her life. She remembered the morning after she and Will had got engaged, when that thought had first occurred to her. The glorious sense of relief. No more new, unfamiliar bodies. No more awkward conversations about contraception. Just Will. He was all she needed. All she wanted. And now, here she was lying in an ex-boyfriend's hallway. "Life sure can surprise you," her grandmother used to say, mostly about quite unsurprising developments, such as a bad cold, the price of bananas, and so on. "Why did we break up?" she asked Connor. "You and Felicity decided to move to Melbourne," said Connor. "And you never asked if I wanted to come too. So I thought, right, looks like I just got dumped." Tess winced. "Was I horrible? It sounds like I was horrible." "You broke my heart," said Connor pitifully. "Really?" "Possibly,"